You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax. This is the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. We've got a potluck, your favorite, today. You submit the questions. Scott and I will answer them for you. We got lots of really good questions about Webpack and .env, importing modules, the HTML spec, when to use a menu versus a nav tag. Where do you keep your two-factor recovery codes? So stay tuned if you want to rob us. lots of good questions today. We are sponsored by three awesome companies. We got Sentry, does error exception and performance tracking of your applications. Sanity is the structured content CMS. And FreshBooks Cloud Accounting. They are awesome. We'll talk about all of these companies partway through the episode. How you doing today, Scott?
I'm doing good. Just hanging in there. Just hanging in, getting the stuff going. I've been playing a lot in 3D lately. And dude, I'm having so much fun. I'm making generative art. I'm making just neat little patterns.
I saw some of your stuff on Instagram.
It's just fun. It's like endlessly fun to get to play around in 3D. It's like being a little kid. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I just had a bit of an issue with my microphone, as you know. And that always sucks. It makes me want to, I was kind of spiraling. I was like, am I going to be spending my whole day trying to get this up? Like, there's just nothing I hate. Like, I don't mind like debugging computer problems or whatever, but like when you got a lot of work to do and then when it's like audio related, which is kind of outside my wheelhouse, I'm just like, oh my gosh, like all these. That's the thing with having such a big setup is you just introduce more points of failure along the way. But I think it was dirty power at the end of the day. Got to be dirty power. All right, let's get on into it. First question is from Russell Williams. Can you explain import.meta? I mostly work on the same three JavaScript apps for my company, and they all use Webpack and .env. So Webpack is a JavaScript bundler, and .env is a package that is used to inject your environmental variables into your application. So when I never use the newer import.meta feature, I've been checking the newer build tools in personal project, and I'm suddenly seeing import.meta everywhere. And how do I get my VS Code to know what it is? It's always underlined in the wrong area. Shout out to all the devs from Tweed, Ontario. Oh, that's cool. Tweed is it's like a very cool, a lot of people have cottages up in Tweed. So shout out to Tweed. I have no idea what import.meta is. What is this, Scott? I'm just looking at the docs and I've literally never seen this.
Okay, so import.meta is something that you're starting to see in, like this person has mentioned, any of these new build systems. Vite uses import.meta a lot. So therefore SvelteKit and basically anything does. The thing about import meta is it's basically a blank slate to attach metadata for an import. And I know Vite is adding things to that. Their system is adding things. So like what is in import.meta is kind of up to, you know, the system that you're working in, because it says on the MDN docs that import meta has a null prototype, meaning there's nothing inherently attached to import meta. But when you do like an import, let's say you were to just console log import.meta itself, it would return an object with the URL of the current file that's being loaded. So it's basically, this is information about the current import that exists right now, the current file that we're working with, the current module. And it is, it's entirely there just to hold metadata, of which that metadata is nothing explicit. So TypeScript is going to most likely say that I have no idea what's import meta. So you'll want to type that. How do you type globally something like that? Let me even like see if I have something like that set up, because we use import meta in our site. Import.meta. Let's see. Oh, so our import meta, we use it for glob eager, which is a function in Vite. We use it for env variables, which are set via Vite. And we use it, yeah, glob eager, and that's pretty much it. But I'm not doing anything fancy to get this working with TypeScript, so to say, because import.meta is set to any, is typed to any for me. Hmm. So if you had no any on, then you would have to type your import meta somehow. I have not had to type import meta. In fact, I'm just like now realizing that it was set to any. That's why I haven't had any type issues with it. But again, it's really just a location for things to be attached to any given individual file that you're importing.
Yeah.
And there's nothing essentially standardized about it, except for the fact that there'll be the URL of the current file loaded up in there.
So like what other stuff could possibly be attached to it? Because the docs just say, it's an object with a URL property. It's a string.
Yep.
And like that'd be very easy to type globally.
So Vite inserts whatever they have in here. So like I said, there's import.meta.glob and glob eager, which are two functions to do like fancier imports where you can do it based on a glob pattern.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So Vite has added those themselves, right? They've augmented the import meta.
I see. Okay, because you could possibly do like some like dynamic generation there, even if I'm thinking about like import all markdown files, and then the meta would have this specifically generated markdown whichever file. Okay, I get it.
We actually use it in jQuery to do import all .gq.ts files. So import.meta.globeager, and that's something that exists only in Vite, the glob eager.
Cool. So it's kind of interesting. So they made a spec that gives you obviously the URL of the file that was imported. That's a standard, but then like any bundler is able to stick extra stuff onto that should you need it.
Yeah, that's my understanding of it. The spec says it's an empty prototype, or a null prototype, so to say. Yeah. It's interesting stuff, and it's definitely something you're going to see utilized more. The first time that I saw import meta was using Snowpack, and then also in Vite for just about the exact same reasons. So it's definitely something that I think is more of this new ESM world we're going to be living in the browser, and you're going to be seeing it a lot more often. But it's not super important. There's not like some crazy amount of interesting things in there that you need to know. It's going to be like on a per platform basis. All right. Next question is from Benjamin LeBron. Benjamin says, what are your thoughts on publishing and selling HTML and CSS templates or themes? It looks like a great source of passive income, and something like creating an experience dev could whip up and sell online in a marketplace such as ThemeForce or directly on their own website. Love the courses and the podcast. Keep up the good work. So Ben, I have personally tried to do this before, and I sold none. I didn't sell a single one. I put it on ThemeForce. I worked hard on it. Granted, at the end of the day, I'm not a great designer. I built a HTML and CSS and JavaScript theme. This was way back in the day. 2011, I did this thing on ThemeForce. I made not a single penny off that. So what do I think? I think it's probably a great way to make money if you're good at it. And the people who have the popular ones, the ones that are highly configurable, work with WordPress or whatever they need to work with, either way, the ones that are really well executed, I'm sure they do make money. I'm also sure that it's going to be a lot of effort. So if that sounds like the type of effort that you would want to put into something like this, like go for it. But also be prepared that you could put this thing up there and not sell a single copy of it. So, you know, it's an interesting world, and one that I personally, like you, saw initially and was like, oh man, this could be a great way to make some money. And then was instantly like, oh wait, I'm not actually good enough at doing this to make the kind of money that you would want to make off of it.
I have talked over the years to probably four or five people who have done this, whether it's Bootstrap themes, WordPress themes, Tailwind themes,
Magento themes.
Yeah, all of those. And like I've probably met three or four people that have made like jaw dropping money, like enough that you walk away and you go like F word. That's awesome. And then you go tell your wife, like, can you believe it? Like that, like that's the kind of, I think that's one thing that's not talked about is there is lots of very quiet people in very niche corners that have not necessarily stumbled, but have gotten into really good little sneaky, like specifically Bootstrap sells their own themes now. Why? Because there was another company that was doing it for years that was just cleaning up on that. And it also happened when HTML5 came along, people were selling them. That said, everybody tries to do this because you know that there are several people out there that are absolutely cleaning up on this type of thing.
You start doing the math in your head like, oh, they sold how many, how much? Oh, man.
Exactly. Yeah. You're like, oh, man, I can do that, you know, and then you don't. And I also, very early on in my career, I tried to sell a WordPress theme on ThemeForest and it got rejected a couple times and I sort of gave up on that. Mm. So it's definitely worth the try. I think what happens is that a lot of people give away themes for free. It becomes popular. You give away something for free and it becomes very popular. And then you can monetize that traffic and people love it. I think the support for this type of stuff would be a huge, like, you think about the type of developer who uses this is no slant on people who use themes, but generally somebody who's buying a pre-built theme, they're either looking to get up and running quickly or it's because they don't have the skills to do it. And the support on that type of thing must be a nightmare in order to fix people's weird CSS issues and whatnot. So
you'd have to account for a lot of different potential layout. Like people would see this thing and be like, oh, of course I can put a portrait image in this landscape image slot, and then all of a sudden be upset when it's clipping or something like that. You will have to deal with a ton of that kind of stuff.
Absolutely a ton. So I definitely would not want to do that, but it's worth taking a look at. I definitely wouldn't just start a store because I guarantee you that will flop, but start by giving away a whole bunch of stuff. Or if you have another, I bet I could do this. Like, I have a large email list and a large following. If I were to whip up a couple themes for something, I bet I could sell a whole bunch of them, right? It's not something that I'm interested in. But if you have an existing following, like a podcast or email list, you probably could do it as well.
Totally.
Maybe I will. Should I start selling themes?
Do you see how much money I can make?
Yeah. Pre-built hooks with React or something like that. Next question we have here from Perry. When is it best to use the semantic menu tag versus the semantic nav tag in HTML? I was building out a menu component for our storybook library at work and it rabbit trailed. Is it rabbit tailed or gone down a rabbit hole? It's a rabbit hole. It's not a trail. Into a huge discussion over the following days with my team. Menus seem to be used for things like mimicking desktop apps and navs used for linking around the site. But you know what it is like. All of our spas with products are spas with no SSR. So nothing is like a traditional link yet. Yet I don't want to confuse reader impaired people with the wrong context. I hope this gives a glimpse into my angst. What do you think, Scott?
Into my angst. I love the semantic HTML angst. Yeah, this one's interesting. I don't know too much about the HTML menu tag essentially even before this post. It's not widely used. Nav is kind of the way to go if you're doing a navigation. It's funny that I did see that the menu tag was listed as experimental in MDN. So I don't really know too much about if you should use the menu tag or the nav tag necessarily, but I would just use the nav tag and not worry about it, considering that's what it's there for. It's for page navigation. I mean, if you have semantically, what is the difference between a menu and a navigation? In my mind, absolutely nothing. I mean, if it's changing the page route, it's going to be navigating. So I would just use the nav tag and call it a day. The thing about the menu tag is you do have to, the menu tag is analogous to an unordered list, as in it expects list items inside of there. But a nav tag doesn't necessarily expect anything inside of it other than links. So I don't know. If you're asking me personally, I would use the nav tag specifically because it's not listed as experimental. And
this is bizarre.
Yeah. That's what it's there for.
The menu tag was deprecated in HTML 4.01 and included again in HTML 5.1 spec, but it is still marked as experimental, and it looks...
And it's also kind of incomplete, yeah, because there's things in it that are listed all as menu item sort of stuff that's not complete. So, yeah, I would use nav.
So it looks like menu is this part of the proposal here is that it using an HR will create a separator. So if instead of like using a UL LI, you could just do like a menu with the anchor links inside of it. And then the HR between both of them. And you can have labels. It seems like menu is not cooked. I would not use it. I would. It's funny. Like I would have said like, oh yeah, menu. And for me, what do I do? I'll use a nav tag. And then inside of that, I'll still use a unordered list with the list item inside of it.
I don't do that. Yeah. I just do straight up links inside.
Straight up links inside. Yeah. It's what actually do I? Let me look at westboss.com. Pretty sure I get, I have a nav tag. Inside of the nav tag, I have my H1. And a UL with the actual thing, and then a list item. And then I think I did that because you just have a bit more control over each of the items, especially because I've got little descriptions above. So yeah, there's nothing wrong with just having a nav tag and throwing your links directly in there. You do have to worry about the difference between putting a link on each line and putting links beside each other because they're inline elements. And if your CSS fails for whatever reason, they'd all be mashed together if they're on the same line. And often minifiers will do that.
Hmm.
So maybe, oh, that's interesting. I love going down those little rabbit holes, but like, that's pretty clear that you probably shouldn't use menu. It's like half cooked and not really supported. So
going down the rabbit trail. All right. Let's actually take a quick second to talk about one of our sponsors today. This episode is sponsored by Sentry at sentry.io. It's the perfect place to see all of your errors and exceptions happening in a lovely interface. And you know what? I love Sentry. I've talked about this all the time, but I recently have launched a new UI for Level Up Tutorials, which believe it or not, it's a lot of work, a lot of potential bugs. And there's been nothing like having something like Sentry to be able to quickly and make sure that I can resolve any of my individual errors. And I was really just having a big error with our video player lately. And it was so nice after I marked that thing as resolved to be able to see that this error has not popped up again. And that makes me feel good. You know what else I really appreciate about Sentry is that they're always improving upon their interface. I feel like I say this like every other week, but I'm in this thing all the time, and they just added some new little lines to their graphs showing you how frequently these errors have popped up. And I gotta love that a product that's always improving on itself. So check it out at sentry.io. It's the perfect place to capture all of your errors and exceptions, handle them, track them, attach them to users, send them to GitHub, do all that stuff and more. It's just really a top tier tool. So you'll want to head to sentry.io and use the coupon code TASTYTREAT, all lowercase, all one word, and you will get 2 months for free. Thank you so much for Sentry for sponsoring. All right, next question is from Tom. Tom says, as a newbie web dev, which browser do you recommend, Chrome or Firefox Dev Edition? Tom, I recommend you utilize and use mini browsers because besides wanting to check your application, especially in Safari, you'll want to check it in many of these browsers. And I typically I have like a Chrome Canary, a Firefox Dev, I have an Edge Dev, whatever, a Safari. I have all of these Safari technical preview. I have all of these browsers on my computer. And the easiest way in my experience to bounce back and forth between browsers is to always have extensions like a password manager, like 1Password or something. And then honestly, if I switch over to another browser, logging into my stuff isn't difficult because I have 1Password set up and I can switch browsers all the time. The only reason why I like to do this personally is because like you get a feel for how other people use the web because everybody uses their own browser. Everybody has a browser of choice and there's reasons why they like it and dislike it. And if you can use the web in many different browsers, you can understand exactly how sites are going to feel on them and just the general feel of using these browsers. Now, if you had to pick one browser, I don't know, probably just pick Chrome. It has the best support and really amazing dev tools and gets updated all the time. And there's a great team of people working on it, but you know, if it was up to me and I'm like you're one browser on a desert island, I would probably pick Chrome. That said, I've been using Edge for the past, I don't know, 3 months now, and it's been totally good. Somebody was on my YouTube channel comment being like, why would you use Edge as a Mac user? I don't know, man, just give it a try. Who cares?
Yeah, those people don't get it that it's like, it's not It's not your mama's edge, you know? It's it's changed.
This isn't your
it's
mama's
just Chrome
edge.
Under the hood, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have been using Firefox for years, Firefox Dev Edition for years. It's been awesome. I've absolutely loved it. I noticed recently that like when I like come back from locking my computer, it's a little bit like laggy and YouTube videos will stutter.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have to like just wait a couple of minutes and it will fix itself. So like that's kind of annoying. I don't know what it is. I haven't looked into it too much, but yeah, we're in such a good spot with browsers these days where like it's really hard to have some sort of argument as to one is better than the other anymore. They're all very, very good.
Yeah, use whichever one you like, whichever one you feel like. Don't be afraid to try another one. Bounce back and forth. Do whatever you want.
Next question we have here from Alex Nielsen. Hi, guys. Great show. Been a listener since episode one. That's impressive because that is a lot of listening. I'm just starting to dabble with TypeScript. I've never used a type language before. I've done some MERN stack projects before, but I'm trying to decide if TypeScript types are like creating models in Mongoose. I've looked at several basic TypeScript tutorials, but I've never heard anyone draw the comparison. So I'm wondering if I'm on the right track. It kind of is. Like he's talking about when I'm making a database, you're working with any database, you are defining a what do you call that? A
schema.
Model. Yeah, a schema. And in that schema, you say, like, okay, I have a customer. In that, you're going to say the customer will have a name, that's a string, a number, or an age, which is a number, and they'll have courses, which is a relational to another model, and all that. So it is very, very similar. It's not as full-featured as a lot of these database ORMs are in that often they'll have like specifically MySQL is like 18 different types of numbers that you can store in it. Or you can, there's a couple different types of strings. Often these ORMs will have validation built in. That's kind of one thing that TypeScript doesn't do. You say it's a string, but you can't say it's a string that starts with a capital and it must be between 7 and 8 letters long, right? There's no validation.
You could do that in TypeScript, couldn't you?
No. Like if you were to like set a string to something in TypeScript, it wouldn't actually validate that the string inside of that meets your values, does it?
Yeah, you could do stuff like that.
How?
I'm nearly positive you can.
I'm pretty positive you can.
Okay. Well, I'll do some digging, and then if I find something, I'll speak up in the.
Another thing you can do is you can also generate your types from your database. That's a pretty common thing to do because, especially with GraphQL, is you define your schema and then like you can generate your TypeScript types as well as your GraphQL types all from that, and that's really, really nice to be able to do that. So I think you're sort of on the right track. It's a little bit more limited, but you definitely are on the right track there.
Yeah, and I mean it is. It's just describing what the types of your things are, whether that is. You know, like you said, you're defining the model. So it's the model for the data, the interface, whatever. It is just the individual types. And if that's what you need to think about it, yeah, I think that's definitely a good way to think about it. But also, I mean, we have GraphQL is also just defining the types of things. And in anytime you're working with data, it's always kind of a good idea to know what the types of your things are. And JavaScript is not necessarily a unique language, but it's one of the more unique features in the language of JavaScript, that fact that it is untyped. And not typed, it's loosely typed, in that JavaScript itself does not care about reassigning types to things. But things do have a type. You use the type of variable to see if something's a string or whatever in JavaScript.
To answer your question, I just Googled TypeScript string with length, because on our uses.tech website, we want people to pick from a list of like phones and countries and things like that. And like you say, like, okay, give me a country code that is 2 letters long. You can't, at least I did never found a way to say, this is a string, but only a string with the length of 2 things. You can say it can be Canada, CA, or US, or NZ, or like you can list out all the possible options, but I've never found a way to say, just give me a string with 2 letters, or like you could regex it. Like prop types is like that in React, where you can actually run code against it.
Hmm.
I don't know. Did you find something? Because I would love to be able to do that.
I swear I saw somebody on Twitter being like, holy cow, you can do this. And it was like a really, really tight validation to a string in JavaScript or in TypeScript. So I don't know. I'm going to keep looking for it. But I swear I saw somebody talking about it. I haven't done it personally.
What was it the like types from a template string where if you have like two unions, like for example, in like Tailwind, you could have like blue, red, green, and then you could have 100, 200, 300, 400, 500, right? So like between mm-hmm. those three colors and those six weights, you could have like many, many combinations, and you can generate those possible options with backticks in TypeScript. And you can just put like colors dash weights, and it will automatically generate all every permutation of each of those colors and weights. So that maybe that was it.
Yeah, I'll keep my brain on it, and I'll let you know if I think of something. But you're right. I mean, until I can prove you wrong, you're totally right.
Well, tweet us. I would love to be proved wrong here, because that would be amazing if you could do that in TypeScript. Because I often think, like, even on our users.tech, we have a whole library that does the validation. When somebody submits their own entry, there's a whole GitHub action that validates the data to check that they have imported the data properly, right? Like, there's mm-hmm. like sometimes people will put country none, you know, like that's not a country, you know, like you can't put none in there. So like it'll validate and fail the pull request on them.
Okay. Well, let's move on. Next question here is from Chris. If you use 2FA, where do you store your recovery codes? Yeah, this is not something that either Wes or I should be answering on a like an archived medium. So I will not tell you where I keep my codes. I will not tell you how to access them, whether that is physical or digital or whatnot. I am not the type of person to give up that kind of security information.
I will tell you what your possible options are. Some people put them in their 1Password. You might say like, oh, isn't that kind of, if someone gets into your 1Password, then you're kind of screwed anyways. Also, there's a flip side of if you get locked out of your 1Password, you don't have your recovery codes to get in. So that's kind of a downside as well. People always ask us, like, why, even with the two-factor codes in general, why would you put them in 1Password where your password also is? And the answer to that is because in order to get into your 1Password, you still need two factors. You need your master password, and you need to set it up from another device that has 1Password installed, right? So you physically need a secondary device. You need to think about two things. Like, if somebody's going to get access to your recovery, two-factor recovery codes, can they possibly get it in one thing? Like one way they could get it is you put it in your backpack and someone steals your backpack. They did one thing there and you're pooched, right? You need two things. You need to know, like, where are the codes? Are they in your house? Are they at your in-laws? Are they in a safety deposit box at the bank? Is it in a safe in some sort of other location? So that's one, is where is it? And second is, like, how do I access them? Like, do I have to break into your house and break mm-hmm. into a safe in order to get it? Or if somebody breaks into your house, is there a piece of paper, or is it on a sticky note? Oh my gosh, we went through a real estate showing the other day, and the freaking guy had his passwords on sticky notes all on the monitor. And I was like, buddy, don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that. It's funny, those types of things. I always love it when you're like watching a sports broadcast and they'll like cut to the announcer's booth and there'll be like a sign in the background. It's like, Wi-Fi password is. Yeah. He's like, it's like the private Wi-Fi network of the arena.
Come on. So That's the answer is, we're not going to tell you, but whatever you do with them, make sure there is still two steps in order for a malicious actor to get to them.
Yeah, it's not entirely a bad idea to have them like written on a piece of paper in a vault or something, like in a safe. I mean, that's not a terrible idea.
I think it's a lot of them will prompt you to print them as you generate them. And then, yeah, you could, if you've got a safety deposit box, or if you have a safe in your house, which is additionally protected by a layer of door locks, that's pretty good, I think.
You keep them in the fridge. Call it cold storage.
Ooh, that's good.
Yes.
Next question is from Anon. Hey guys, TLDR, do you know a programming language which is similar syntax to JavaScript without the need for of a runtime framework? I'm a front-end developer with all kinds of stuff in JavaScript. Also Node.js for small desktop tools, and generally I reach for Electron. The thing is that Node Electron tools are kind of huge in file size. Even compressed, it's impossible to have empty apps less than 50 megs. Because of this, I want to try another programming language. I don't want to do something like C or Java because for those, the user would need some sort of framework to run such apps. Is there something similar that to the syntax of JavaScript, but without the need for a browser framework to run compiled? So that's kind of interesting. Is like, yeah, like you think about like, oh, what do you care about 50 megs? Like, well, maybe he's trying to run code on a very small device, like a Raspberry Pi or an integrated circuit. Like there's a reason like people writing code for chips are not writing JavaScript that runs on the chip. They're writing lower level language. And the easier it is to program stuff, JavaScript being very high in the easy level, the more that comes along with it in terms of like, it has to run in this very special environment, which is a browser-based or node-based environment. And it doesn't work in like very low level chipsets or like on like a camera or something like that. Right. So to answer that is, I don't know. I don't think so. Yeah. There's been like, I think back to the episode we just did on Cloudflare workers, they have made their own version of JavaScript that just is, you can still write JavaScript, but they've written their entire interpreter at Cloudflare. And I'm assuming because it is fast and small. And even then there are explicit limitations that they have put in place so that you still get that. So everything is a trade-off in life.
Yeah. It's tough too. I mean, if you're wanting to use web tech to make native apps, there is going to be the browser is the limitation there. Whether you are using Electron or there's a new Rust-based one called Tauri, which Tauri, T-A-U-R-I, ooh. Tauri. Yeah. And these things, they can be large, they can be hefty, certainly, but that is kind of the price you're paying for that ease of use. If you're wanting like a small native app, native, you're going to get into more languages that are closer to the metal there. You're going to be getting into your C's, your Rusts, your those types of things to, and you're probably going to have to do your whole visual layouts using GUI kits in those things if you don't want to get the browser involved. But I personally don't, I don't know of any JavaScript-like thing that exists in that regard. You know, maybe the closest thing you could come up with would be React Native. I know there's this is so stupid, but there's a React Native and a React Native Web, which allows you to write websites using React Native. I wouldn't be surprised if there's like a React Native desktop or something as well. And then you're kind of writing JavaScript, and it's probably not going to be Electron-based, but I honestly have no clue there. I do think if you're wanting to write JavaScript or whatever, you're getting into this web tech, you're going to have the browser as an overhead.
I'm going to ask a question. I'm going to let Scott answer it here because Scott is a little bit more featured in it. So this question's from Anon. A lot of Anon people asking questions today. I'm not feeling the hype for Remix. I would rather put my energy into SvelteKit, which has a 3+ year head start and seems to offer 99% of the same benefits. Am I missing something?
Yeah, SvelteKit's not 3+ years old. So they don't have that much of a head start, if anything, because SvelteKit was started to work on, I don't know, I'm trying to remember when, but it wasn't that long ago. And they're kind of different ideas.
Remix has been in the works for
a while.
The pandemic. Like, the reason why
over a year, yeah,
they started it is because their training business fell apart when the pandemic hit, so they had to pivot to something else. So two years.
They're very different in a lot of ways. If you're comparing directly Remix to SvelteKit, you'd be making the mistake of saying that Remix is a React framework like Node or Next.js that's dealing entirely with React, where really what Remix is doing is more working with the server side, generating HTML and pushing that in more so than it is the same way that SvelteKit is server side rendering with client side hydration. That one's a little bit more similar to Next.js in terms of how it's doing things. So Remix is taking a very different approach to things. There's also some really killer features in terms of having like you know, your server endpoints exist in the exact same files and routes as your client-side code, or your UI code, I should say. Now, granted, I actually saw some neat SvelteKit issues and PRs around doing that exact same thing, which gets me very, very excited. I saw that and I was like, this is like the one feature from Remix that I really appreciated having, was like the export of the, they're called actions or whatever the get data one is. We just talked about this the other day, but either way, I would say you're missing something, because Remix is doing something very different than both SvelteKit as well as Next.js or in these other modern ones. But me personally, I'm not like jumping off the SvelteKit boat to go to Remix, because I would prefer to write Svelte myself. It's like you're either writing Svelte or you're writing React there. Maybe you're writing Svelte in the future for Remix. Who knows? That could be a thing. But same benefits? I don't know. The developer experience is great for both of them. So they're not really the exact same, and they're certainly not. SvelteKit's existence doesn't invalidate Remix's existence. So I think you might be missing the coolness of Remix. Maybe give it a little test drive and see, like, all right, this is kind of neat.
I think that's part of the hardest thing for Remix, is trying to explain to people, like, this is not another Next.js. Like, it does some of the same stuff, and yes, it uses React, but we're also going to be doing other frameworks as well. It's more like, if I've learned anything from checking out Remix, it's not that it's like another framework. It's the sort of methodology of approaching server rendered applications.
Exactly. Yeah.
And if you're not like getting it, I would probably just like sit on it for a little while. There's definitely a lot of hype around it right now. And you might also be put off by some of that, because there's everybody saying it's the best thing in the world. And I'm really excited about it as well. But like maybe sit on it for 6 months, a year, and then see where it is in a year from now. Because then we'll see like a lot of applications that are built on it. A lot of people have sort of fleshed it out. See, and like I said, okay, we've built a real thing on this. Let's see where we're at with it.
Yeah, I agree. Well, let's take a quick second to talk about another one of our sponsors today, which is Sanity.
Sanity. Wes,
if you're building a site with Remix or SvelteKit, you can take advantage of something like Sanity, right?
There you go. I wonder. Let's take a look here. Sanity.io, of course, they have, in November already, they had a blog post, how to build a Remix website with Sanity.io and live preview, which is really, really cool. Oh, that's cool. They've put their live preview in there. Let's talk about that for this ad read. What is live preview? Well, you're building these websites and you change your data. You want to see that data reflected in real time when you're updating your website, right? You don't have to push a thing and build it and say, oh, it doesn't look good, or oops, I forgot something. So Sanity has this thing called live preview, which I've integrated with my Gatsby website. As soon as you update the data in your back end, it will immediately render on the front end. And like developers like that, but more importantly, marketers like that, because then they're able to see what it looks like before you hit the publish button, right? Totally. So that is wicked. Check it out. I'm going to link to the Sanity.io guide for running Remix with Sanity.io, because that would be a really fun project for you to do. You can also use Sanity to get our special link, sanity.io/syntax, that will get you double the free usage tier, which is very, very generous. Thank you, Sanity, for sponsoring.
Sick. Cool. All right. Next question here is from Miguel. Hey, guys. I've been listening to the show the past year, and I have been loving it. I actually started listening when I decided that I wanted to start a career in web development. I've taken several recommended courses, including Wes's beginner JavaScript and Scott's CSS tutorials, but I feel like I'm stuck in tutorial hell for a while now. I know that I want to be a front-end developer, but I'm not sure if I have the skills to be one yet. Do you guys have any advice on getting unstuck from tutorial hell? And at what point do you think someone is ready to apply for junior web dev jobs? Okay, so this is a common thing I see, especially from newer developers all the time, is that they get stuck in this mode where they're just constantly following paint by the numbers and doing the tutorial. All right, I have the thing, it's done. But I don't necessarily feel confident in going out and writing a ton of my own code. And or it can feel maybe more intimidating to do it without the safety net. Now, I typically often have the same advice for these kind of situations, is that when you're working in tutorial code, like make it your own in some sort of way, adapt it, and don't, if somebody's doing like a project or tutorial that's a to-do list, change it to be something that's like a grocery list. It's very, it's the exact same thing. It's very similar. You're going to be doing the same techniques, but just the simple act of writing different words down than what the tutorializer, the teacher is doing, right? By writing a different word than what the teacher is doing, you're therefore not essentially painting by numbers as much. You're kind of having to think, why was this thing named to be this thing? Why did I write this thing at all in the first place? What is this thing that I'm actually working with? And it takes you out of that headspace a little bit. But in as far as like what you should be thinking about in terms of like, when should I start applying? Apply for jobs. There's no harm in going for an interview and not getting that job, because every interview you go into, every code test you take is practice for the next one. You go into a job interview, they say, do this FUBAR BAS thing. You say, oh, I don't know how to do that. Then you look it up after the interview. You crash and burn, you look it up after the interview. Next interview, they say, hey, do this FUBAR BAS thing. You say, oh, I can do that. I kind of have the idea, or I've at least gained some exposure to know what the interview process is like. People often, like, they fear the rejection of not getting a job. They fear the rejection of, oh, this interviewer is going to think I'm bad at code or something like that. But in my experience, interviews, just like many other things, are just as much of a matter of practice as they are anything else. Because you could go into a job interview with mediocre skills, but confidence and open-mindedness and get the job still, or you could go just not do it at all and never gain that experience.
Yeah.
So in my opinion, apply early, apply often, apply frequently, rack up that practice, get that experience for what job interviews are going to be like. And maybe you land the job, and maybe that job turns into the mentorship you needed to become a great developer.
Beautifully put. I don't think I have anything to add to that. That was really well put.
Well, thank you.
Next question from here is from Gonzalo Diaz. Do you feel frameworks like Next.js, Remix, etc., extract too much of the complexity that it takes to build full stack web apps? I've dabbled in these frameworks, and it's definitely a breeze to build a project. It's a matter of hours to get something up and running, but I sometimes feel I am not really learning how things work on the inside, both on the front end and back end, as the architecture and logic is already defined, and I don't think about it too deeply. Absolutely not. No, there's I've built complicated apps with Next. I've built complicated apps without Next. You still have to understand how the server works. You still have to understand how. You definitely don't know have to know how SSL certificates and like deploying and continuous integration. A lot of that is like the where Vercel ends and Next.js starts is kind of blurry for a lot of people. And absolutely, take all that stuff away from me. I've never felt like I'm too far away from like core Node. It's always just like, oh wow, this is really nice. Oh wow, you gave me the query params in an object. Oh wow, this is like the stuff that they do add and is all really nice. And I've never found that I have to like eject out of something in order to get access to something that I totally couldn't. So absolutely not.
Yeah. I almost feel like frameworks don't give you enough sometimes. There's so many little things where you're like, wait, why can't you just do this for me? This is a tedious thing that you have to do on every project, or maybe it's a security-based thing. You know, it's like things like I think about, I know like in React, it's like use effect, can infinite loop, or it can do this, or can it do that? It's like, well, why can't it do it for me? Why do I have to worry about that? Or even like you should memoize things that don't change. Well, why do I have to do that? Like, I don't want to have to be responsible for those types of optimizations or those types of little things, because the more things I'm responsible for, it's the more things I have to keep in my brain, the more things that I could potentially break, the worse performance I could accidentally have, the worst accessibility my application could have, or any of these things. Like, do more for me and let me focus on making the fun stuff.
Absolutely. I agree. I don't think... I don't know, you're some sort of sicko. You like things to be harder for you, I guess, but don't know.
Yeah, you like being dominated by your code.
What's next, Scott?
Next question is from John Ferguson. How do you keep up on new technologies? I try to keep up with everything coming out, but there is so much it gets extremely overwhelming. How do you even know what to keep up with? Okay, so yeah, this, you know what, for me, I follow a lot of really smart and interesting people on Twitter who are doing a lot of interesting things. And the cool thing about interesting and smart people is that they tweet out a lot about the stuff that they work on, and then you can pick up and get a good handle on it. Another one that people often don't say is funny. Wes has a little list here, so I'll let him do his list. I'll just knock out a couple of mine here first.
Sure.
One that people don't often say is that GitHub. The GitHub app has an explore page that's really super good for finding new projects. In fact, I've been like very... like I found quite a bit of things from the GitHub Explore page. Or if you follow people on GitHub that are constantly doing cool things, like if I follow somebody like Swix, like Sean Wang, right? He likes a lot of cool projects. So I'll occasionally open up my GitHub, and on the homepage, it'll be like, Swix has starred this repo. And I'll say, oh, that's an interesting repo. Let me take a look at that. And if you follow the right people, man, interesting and smart people, people who are diving into cool new projects all the time, those kind of people are always looking out for stuff and are always finding new things. So follow those types of people. Follow me and Wes on GitHub and Twitter, and you know, buy all of our courses and do all that stuff as well while you're at it. No, I'm just joking on that last one. But in reality, I have a newsletter where I publish 5 links of new projects every single week. So I'll post a link to that newsletter in this show notes. But if you are looking for new things all the time and want to maybe just even just have them in your brain, we go straight to your dome in the newsletter, the Level Up links every week. So subscribe to our mailing list.
Straight to your dome. I like that. Subscribe, folks. Yep. We've answered this so many times, and this is probably the most common question that people get. Like, hey, like, how do you possibly know what's new? How do you keep up? It seems like it changes so quickly. We've answered it many times, but we get so often, let's answer it again. Listen to this podcast. Honestly, like, yes. The reason why Scott and I dig into every little thing here and there, and sometimes it flops and sometimes it doesn't, is so that you don't have to. It's you can just passively listen to this and sort of get your head around the scope of what's out there and what things are and what they're for. And I always tell people, if you hear about it 12 times, then check it out. Don't check it out now, because it will probably change, or it might flop, or there will be 6 major versions before it's stable. But by the 12th time that we talked about it, then yeah, maybe it's time to start checking out, right? And unless you're super into being early and excited about new stuff, you don't necessarily have to check it out until everybody's figured it out, and then it's time for you to look in. Like, you may think like, oh, I'm getting out of date, I'm falling behind. You have to like not check out anything for a very, very long time to fall behind in this industry. Like, yeah, it moves quick, but I don't know, we're still talking about the same stuff we were talking about like 4 years ago when we started this podcast. There's a couple things that have spiked up here and there, but also it's just JavaScript, right? Like, as long as you are good at JavaScript, then you'll be able to very, very quickly, like Scott was saying in the last episode, man, I haven't done any serverless. And I was just like, after we hung up, I was like, you would 100% be able to build something in the next hour. Why? Because he knows JavaScript. He knows how servers work. There's not anything special about it, except for a couple little gotchas here or there.
Yeah, just haven't done it.
Another big one, browser release notes. So specifically, Firefox has really good release notes, and Safari have really good release notes. And when those things release, especially Safari, because when Safari releases something, they're usually the last one to implement it. And then you know, okay, now that it's in Safari, we can start using it everywhere. So just read the release notes of Safari and say like, oh, they added this and this and this. Now we can go ahead and start using this thing in all of our applications. Stage 4, JavaScript approvals. So take a look at, there's a GitHub repo of JavaScript proposals. I love looking at stage 0 just because you see what people are dreaming up for the language. But like it'll be a year or two before that stuff actually gets approved. And then by the time it's actually implemented in the browsers, might be another 6 months, a year. So just look at stage 4. By the time it hits stage 4, though, sometimes it's in half of the browsers already. So there's that. CSS Working Draft has a list of things that are being proposed and whatnot. Again, we'll have those people on the podcast and talk about stuff that's coming down the pipe. Like, what are the two big ones that Miriam had? Container queries and layers. Yeah. So yeah. Like, we talked about that. How long ago was that? Let's look. November 10.
I would say it's 6 months ago. Yeah.
Yeah. No, so, November, yeah. December, January. Yeah, almost four so months ago.
4 months ago. Yeah.
We talked about this and they've been working on that for months before that. And we're still not there, you know? So that stuff moves fast in relation to like adding new features, but like not fast enough that you're going to hear about it on Syntax. And then 2 months later, it's everybody's using it. It goes much slower than that. There's a Twitter called Intent to Ship, which is, I tweet when browser makers announce their intent to ship, change, or remove features to their web engines.
Oh,
so
that's neat.
Blink, intent to ship, prototype, abort signal, dot timeout, static method. So that's kind of interesting. I think that's for canceling fetch requests. If I were to
look
at that.
That's the one we've all been waiting on.
Yeah. Let's look at the like likes and retweets. I'm trying to find one that like got really, really popular. Here we go. January 18, Blink, intent to ship, prototype, CSS subgrid. There you go. Finally, we talked about subgrid probably 2 years ago on the podcast. Finally, Blink is Chrome is adding CSS subgrid. So finally, holy smokes, that took forever, right? So that's exciting.
I've never heard of this Twitter. This is pretty neat.
Yeah, it's just another really good way. Like, there's weirdos out there that love following this stuff, and they will distill it down so it's easy for us regular folks to do it. Follow people on Twitter. Just if you're on Twitter, you will find, there's no list or anything like that, but you will find the people that are consistently posting about new stuff to Twitter. Like specifically the other day, Scott posted, Fetch is finally being added to Node.js, right? That's really exciting. And
it's so exciting.
Yeah.
it is really exciting. Yeah.
I just figured out it's also being backported to Node 16.
Yeah,
which is really
I heard
good
that
because
too.
Because the even versions are what go LTS, long-term support. So that means that like often people will not move up to a new version of Node until it's on LTS. So the fact that it's going to be backported to 16 means that we'll be able to start using it much sooner than if it was just a 17. You have to wait for it to get into 18, and then 18 was released, and then 18 LTS is released. You know, like there's all that, and then it's not an AWS Lambda, so like people aren't using that. It'll be probably a year or two before we can stop importing isomorphic fetch, but it'll be a good day.
It's funny. Someone is like, well, why have this when we have Node fetch? But it's like, well, we don't just have Node fetch. We have Node fetch. We have isomorphic fetch. We have many different people who are trying to do the same thing. We have those facts that those are third-party dependencies when we just had issues with, you know, owners of third-party dependencies pulling their dependency off of NPM. But there's also the fact that, like, Dino's got it. It's part of the browser API. It's like how you fetch things on the web. Like having that cross-compat is going to be awesome for any site that uses server-side rendering and anybody who likes to use, you know, the same command on your client and your server. It's just going to be nice.
The node fetch, sorry, if you're wondering, should I use node fetch or isomorphic fetch for now? I would say use isomorphic fetch. And the reason behind that is because isomorphic fetch simply just serves up either node fetch or what WG fetch, which I'm assuming is the browser version of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming this package will be updated to use the natively installed version eventually.
So you'll be like, eventually get a reduction.
It will just
size.
Use the built-in one. Eventually that will be rewritten in Node to be like native C++. And then eventually you can just delete the import entirely.
Eventually.
Cool. That is all of our questions for today. Thanks everyone for submitting them. Please keep them coming. Go to syntax.fm and hit the button that says ask a potluck question. And just submit your question about literally anything, soft skills, hard skills, JavaScript, love, life, happiness. We will answer it.
This episode is sponsored by one of our awesome, most favorite sponsors over here on Syntax. They've been with us for so long, FreshBooks. Wes, do you want to talk about FreshBooks?
I do. FreshBooks is the cloud accounting. I've talked about them tons and tons of times. They are really cool because you can do all of your invoicing, all of your expenses, all of your income. Guess what? They have mileage tracking now. So if you are driving for work and you get compensated per kilometer for work, FreshBooks now has mileage tracking built in. That is really cool. They've had it built in for a long time. I've just have not talked about it because generally you don't bring your computer on the road. But if you do a job where you have to go visit clients or something like that and you get paid per mile, that is built right into FreshBooks. It's really, really cool. So check it out. FreshBooks.com/syntax. That's going to get you a 30-day unrestricted free trial. Thank you, FreshBooks, for sponsoring.
Sweet. Okay, now let's get into the part of the show that we call sick picks. We pick things that we think are pretty sick. Sick isn't cool. Wes, do you have a sick pick for us today?
I do. This is another, man, a couple of podcasts ago, I sick picked the Truff hot sauce. Mm. And like 100 people bought it and was like, it's just been so many good convos on Twitter about the hot sauce. And then like that's opened my eyes to a whole bunch of new hot sauces I had never tried. And I've tried most hot sauces in the world, but there's a couple out there that I was like, I've never had that. And this is specifically one. It's called Mike's Hot Honey.
Oh my gosh. Which, is it the same Mike as Mike's Hard Honey?
Or Mike's Hard Lemonade. I always make the joke that that was my nickname in high school. I always tell that to my wife when she says something funny.
Oh my God.
She's like, Mike's Hot Honey? I was like, that was my nickname in high school. Anyways, Mike's Hot Honey is literally in the name. It's honey that's been infused with chilies. And it is awesome because if you ever had like a little bit of honey brushed on your pizza, that's really good. But having it spicy is very, very good. So it's a little bit of a shocker of how expensive it is. It was $18 for a bottle of it. But if you think about like what does nice honey cost? It's usually $10-$12 for a nice bottle of honey. So not that much more for getting a little bit of hot honey. And it's a nice treat. I doubt that I would go through this very quickly because it's honey. You're not slathering it on like it's Frank's. You're just putting a little bit on some pizza. So I highly recommend it. Check it out. Mike's Hot Honey. I'll link it up in the show notes.
Yeah. And if you are the type of person who's thinking honey on pizza, that's actually like a big Colorado thing, Wes.
Is it really?
You know how like, yeah. So I didn't know this. I'd never heard it. You know, everybody's got their own type of pizza now. You know, I love me some Michigan pizza or Detroit style pizza, but Colorado style pizza is like this one Colorado. It's like a restaurant. There's like a few of them, one of which is in the mountains and whatever. And they do this like terrible big crust. It's like a giant piece of big crust at the end of it. That's kind of you can rip it really easily and it's seasoned, but then they bring you to your table a big thing of honey that you're supposed to dip it in. So like, that's like, it's like part of the whole thing is you eat the pizza. Then when you have the crust, then you dip the crust in the honey while you eat the crust. It's like, their whole thing.
That's amazing. Oh man, I need to come and check that out.
It's good. It's very good. That was my first experience with honey and pizza. And I was like, oh, I get it. This is really neat. This is very, very good. Okay. I'm going to sick pick another documentary on Netflix because, you know, I love me some wilderness, some outside documentaries, some adventuring kind of stuff. And this one is going to be very similar to the last two where they were mountain climbing ones. Oh, stop. Sorry, Netflix is doing some sound in my ear. This is going to be a documentary in the same alley as The Alpinist and 14 Peaks. And this is called The River Runner. And it's about a kayaker who kind of like really pushed the boundaries of the sport kayaking when he was younger and some of his like struggles in life. But just some of the insane stuff. The River Runner.
Yes, I've seen this.
Did you watch it?
Unreal. It was very much like the mountain climbing one, but like, holy smokes, man.
There's like one river he was doing, and I don't remember where it was, but there were like literal alligators like snapping at him as he's going kayaking like around alligators. Yeah. And it's like, why would you do that? It is so amazing. And at the same time, really, really just cool. You know, I actually, I have a really funny kayaking story, not kayaking, but whitewater rafting story wise. Yeah. I don't know if I've ever told this on the podcast. I might have. This is very potentially being told on the podcast before, but my neighbor at our old house, he's like a really cool guy, but he's like super adventure-y. And he's very adventurous. He's trying to get me to go rock climbing in like actual rock faces in the mountains and stuff. And he's always trying to get me to do fun stuff. So he asked me to go whitewater rafting for his birthday. And I was like, yeah, I'll do it. Oh, I think I told the story right after it happened. I went whitewater rafting for this guy's birthday. And it turns out it was like the hardest rapids in Colorado. It was 30 degree water. So the only reason it wasn't frozen is because it was a river.
Oh my gosh.
He asked to sit in the front of the tube. Two people in our tube asked to be picked up halfway through because it was too scary. They had to tap out halfway through. It was like an 8-hour excursion. We did 24 class 4 rapids and several class 5 rapids, like many of them back to back. And it was like somebody had died on that same route a year earlier.
Oh my
and I
gosh.
Didn't know any of this. I was just like, yeah, we're going to go casually whitewater rafting. Let's go. And then I get there and it's like the hardest thing. It was so... Like, I got home and I was just like, I'm so happy to be home. I'm so happy to be alive right now.
Yeah, that documentary is unreal. And it's funny because I feel like I've watched that documentary in like 4 or 5 different sports.
Oh,
and
yeah,
it's
totally.
Always the same.
Yes,
it's someone who's just like hellbent on doing this crazy thing. There's always like the apathetic wife who's just like, I don't know, he's gonna kill himself, but that's him.
The stories are always so similar in many of those ways. The personalities all have like very distinct characteristics. Yeah.
That's I always wonder about that. Like, there's just any of these people that are so gung-ho about one thing in life, everything else in their life is usually in shambles because they're so dead focused on this one thing. And it's very, very interesting. But yeah, highly recommend that. It's super good.
Yeah, cool. All right, shameless plugs. I'm going to shamelessly plug something different. Usually I'm shamelessly plugging leveluptutorials.com. I'm not doing that this time. I'm going to shamelessly plug the YouTube channel. Many people are surprised to find out that I have a YouTube channel, which is shocking to me because that's where I started.
That's your thing, yeah.
That's my thing. So if you have never heard of it, we have a Level Up Tuts YouTube channel. I will have a link to here where we have thousands of videos, thousands, literally thousands. But more nowadays, what I do on YouTube is I do a couple of weekly shows. So I do a weekly show on Svelte called Weekly Svelte that comes out every single Friday. And I do a weekly show called What Is Web Development, where I take a single thing and do what is. So what is Remix? What is CI/CD? What is this? What is that? What is GraphQL? Where you can learn in under 10 minutes what the heck something is in web development. So if you aren't subscribed to my YouTube channel, join the over 3,000. I'm almost at 340,000. I'm at 339,000 subscribers. So let's get up to 340. Let's even get up to 350. Heck, let's get up to a milli. But yeah, subscribe on Level Up Tutorials on YouTube. I'll post the link in the show notes. Again, this is how I got started in all this stuff. And this channel now has a couple of regular weekly shows. So pop in.
I'm going to switch it up. I usually shamelessly plug my courses as well, but I'll switch it up. I've done a couple coding TikToks. I haven't like nailed it just yet. Haven't totally figured it out just yet, but I've did a couple fun little TikToks. How do you say Veet? I did that one a while ago after Scott could not pronounce it. How to make the browser sing to you. A couple fun ones. Just go on TikTok. I'm Wes Boss and hook it up. That's it.
Yeah, it's funny. Courtney just made a TikTok for the first time because she's getting started with her Learn Differently thing.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, sharing mental health tips. Or talking about for parents of neurodivergent kids and for neurodivergent people themselves. And she was like, well, I made a TikTok. I'm not quite sure what to do with it yet, but I made it and we're gonna see. So she's gonna start, I think, diving into that TikTok world and maybe branching out from doing just Instagram for her project. It still scares me. She was like, why don't you do TikTok? I'm like, to be honest, it kind of scares me.
I've been absolutely loving it. I'm just finding so much info, and like my Instagram has just been a dumpster fire of people fighting.
Instagram is QVC lately. Like,
yeah,
that's all it is.
Yeah, it's half of it is just like stuff for selling. And I don't know how half my friends are angry about everything on the world right now. And rightly so, but it stresses me out to be on there sometimes. So I've been on TikTok a lot more lately, and there's just so much. Like, I've been on Cock Talk, which is like people that are like cocking, yeah, I tried to say that with a straight face.
I know, but I thought it was going to be like rooster based. I was very surprised.
No, there's actually Cock Talk, which is like, people who are really good at with a cocking gun and do like, yeah, real, you know, like sometimes you go to someone's bathroom and it's just like a disaster and someone put way too much cock on and put their finger, yeah, on it and stuff like that.
It
and
takes a lot of practice to be.
There's these
with
guys
cock
that are like next level. And I'm in an old house. I'm cocking stuff all the time. So I've learned a lot about how to properly use the gun and how to angle it and how to cut the tip and all that stuff. So
Have you seen the new style cocking gun that's like half the size and it doesn't have the big long bar,
yeah,
that comes out?
Like, it like cuts the tube as you're cocking.
I have not tried it, and I've been seeing it in ads, and I've been seeing it in YouTube, or I saw it on YouTube on one of the YouTube channels that I know Wes follows because I see him comment occasionally on their videos. So
oh yeah,
I see him comment in the comment section. So yeah, I saw somebody talking about it. It looked kind of neat.
The Silicon, it's called. And
yeah,
I keep going it, but it's like $30, and I don't know. Maybe I should try it. It's because I just bought like a dripless cocking gun, which doesn't, like, you know how with a cocking gun you do it and it just like pees out everywhere when you have to pull the
yeah,
trigger back
stop,
and like
you stop pushing the trigger, yeah, and it's still, you're like, how many paper towels do I need right
for
now,
like $4 at Home Depot? You can get a dripless one which has no spring in it, and as soon as you let off the trigger it stops spewing stuff out.
Oh my god.
I was like, how did I live my whole life? So like, I don't know, Cock Talk, man, it's been great.
Cool.
All right. That's it. Thank you so much for tuning in. We will catch you on Monday.
Peace.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.